In today's modern university, social justice issues are arguably the dominant topic within the humanities and social sciences. But what about the sciences? Few research labs will openly embrace concepts such as feminism or emphasize equity of one sort or the other. At Memorial University, the Civic Laboratory for Environmental Action Research, or CLEAR, is an exception to this. They prioritize equity and attempt to engage the public into scientific research, fundamentally shifting the way that science is done and challenging the basic precepts in which science operates. Welcome to Cross Currents, the Nexus Center's podcast. My name is John Sandloss, director of the Nexus Center. Nexus Center research assistant Alana Felt and I sat down with members of the CLEAR Lab to discuss their principles and their research in marine plastics.
So again, thanks for meeting us here today. We'll just dive right in. So can you guys tell me a bit about what the Civic Laboratory for Environmental Action Research is? Like, what does it do? What is different about its approach to science?
Sure. CLEAR, Civic Laboratory for Environmental Action Research. We are a feminist marine science lab. We focus on marine pollution and particularly plastic pollution. But our approach to that, no matter what we study, whether it would be plastics or something else, is feminism, equity, justice, and goals of solidarity with people who are suffering from pollution, usually disproportionately. So in Newfoundland, that usually means rural, impoverished, low income, women and fetuses, and indigenous populations. So those are the people we do science with, for, etc. Okay. Anyone else want to add in?
Just in terms of its difference to its approach to science. So, you know, we often consider science labs to be central components of not only Western universities, but kind of modernity as a whole, right? And what CLEAR does is it does something really different. It approaches science in a feminist way, which means that our practices within the laboratory are fundamentally different. So they're fundamentally different than any laboratory, in fact, on this campus and in many other campuses around North America. We are nonetheless in connection. We do connect up with other feminist labs around North America. There are a small number of them, and we connect up with them. So our practices are shaped by, and we support a kind of network of feminist labs across North America and Europe.
Yeah, so one of our big things is not just that we study environmental justice questions. A lot of labs do that, but they do it in a non-feminist way. It's literally that the way that we select sites, the way that we sample for things, the way that we bring things back to the lab, what we do for things when we're done with them in the lab, the way that we hire people, where we order materials from, all of those are done with equity as a primary way of doing things, which means literally how we cut open a fish looks different than other people. How we get rid of the fish when we're done with it looks different than other labs. It's really infiltrated into every single aspect of the lab as much as we can. And we're always working on doing it better and differently and learning because a lot of this is building the boat while sailing it. Because even though there are other feminist labs, there ain't a whole lot of other feminist labs.
Very cool. Okay, so we have a big group of people from the CLEAR Lab here. Could I have each and every one of you introduce yourselves a little bit? So tell us about your research background, your role in the lab, and your specific research area.
Sure, I'll start. My name is Max Liberon. I'm a professor of geography. I'm the director of the lab also. So I sort of set a lot of its agenda and do a lot of its training. And my research background, well, I started in biology and I dropped out and went into fine arts and I dropped out and went into, what was next? Visual culture, did some media culture communication work, science and technology studies, and then when I came back to Canada, Harper had been in government for 7 years and decimated environmental programs, so I went back to science to do some of the science that was left undone, critically undone. So that's been my sort of circuitous route. So I don't really have a specific research area. I'm just a feminist in the academy trying to break stuff. Well. Break stuff well. And I go by she or her.
Okay. My name is Emily Wells. I have been a member of CLEAR now for nearly 2 years.
All the years of the lab.
All the years of the lab. I am the CLEAR member that has been here a while. And I'm finishing up my undergrad soon, majoring in biology, minor French. My research now is with CLEAR. I'm also working in a biogeography lab for the summer. And on top of that, I've also dabbled in genetics research and behavioral ecology. Oh, and my name is Emily Wells, and my pronouns are she and her.
My name is France Liboiron. My pronouns are she and her. I recently finished an undergrad with a major in marine biology. I've also been with CLEAR from the beginning, for almost 2 years. I'm now the project manager in the lab, and most of the projects I've worked on have been with ingestion studies with fish, silverhake and codfish.
Is there a relation between you two?
We're not related. When we located each other, we were the only other Liboirons we had either met that we didn't already know, so we gave our family trees to our nans who were in charge of that sort of thing, and they couldn't find a link. Yeah. We must be related, though. But every time I hire France, which is often, I have to put a little note that it's that we're not related on the bottom of the HR forms. Yeah.
I'm Taylor Stocks. My pronouns are they and them. I come from sort of a different background. I've got no background in the sciences. I study decision-making and strategy and facilitation, and I work mainly in knowledge mobilization and public engagement. So I'm definitely really interested in how the lab connects with the communities that it works with, because I think it does a much better job than a lot of other projects that are stemming from the university. And I think the university's got a lot to learn from the way that things are done within CLEAR.
Okay, I'm Charlie Mather. I go by him and he. and I'm a faculty member in the geography department. I'm a colleague of Max's. And that's pretty much why I'm in the lab. Max and I have been working together on various successful SHRC applications. Together we're working, the most recent material that we're working on has to do with salmon. So we're looking at all sorts of issues around salmon conservation, but how you can do different kinds of sciences around salmon conservation.
So you talked a little bit earlier about how CLEAR is a feminist laboratory and what that meant, and I don't know if any of you wanted to elaborate on that at all or possibly talk about what drew you to the concept of feminist science or feminist research.
Y'all are trained to answer this question. And go.
Equity.
Well done.
So initially I got into feminism, what I now reflect on as very white feminist stuff. I was given permission to, like, not shave my armpits and that kind of stuff. But now I realize feminism is so much more than that. And what I was initially drawn to the lab because I was like, feminist, science. I was like, I'm super feminist, I feel, in my heart. and I'm a science student. So then I was like, hey, and Claire was studying, well, Max was studying, because it wasn't Claire at that point. Max was studying marine plastics. So I was like, that's something that sounds cool. And then I kind of, like, going into the lab, I learned that, I learned about feminism was a different thing than that, kind of. So basically everything we do, the reason why we're here in a group, the reason why we, do pronoun checks, everything, is because we do the feminist values of equity and justice in everything we do. So
what's equity?
Equity is different than equality in that everyone starts at different social standings, economic standings. Everyone has their different politics, and we acknowledge that, and therefore we treat everyone differently, so not equal, so that we can finish the sentence.
You get closer to equal outcomes as opposed to giving equal processes that can actually reinforce the problematic discrepancies in where we're coming from in the first place.
Yeah. So, for example, we hire people like Taylor who have no science backgrounds, because if we only hired science students, we would keep getting the same sort of knowledge, the same sort of things. But we can teach Taylor how to cut open a fish and look for plastics, should that be the choice that Taylor would like to do in the lab. I don't think you've got a fish yet, have you?
No. I've built a trawl and used it in a tiny tank. That was really exciting.
There we go. So built a high-tech with pantyhose?
No, this was the netting.
Oh, it was just the netting. Yeah. Okay.
Ice cream buckets.
Ice cream buckets, yeah. So that goes from who we hire. So I have someone who's in their very first semester of university in a new country in the lab, and I also have PhD students, and they're working on the same projects. Sometimes they're already trained in science, sometimes they're not. But that's not what's important when we hire someone. What's important when we hire someone is their dedication to equity and justice and their humility and their ability to collaborate and their values that have to do with sort of being reflexive and recognizing where they are, because that's what makes our science better And sort of marching along as if you're objective and not being able to check in with what you're doing and how it's affecting other things and what the ethics of that might be.
So what does it mean? You talk about on your website to practice place-based or land-based science. What does that mean?
So that's relatively new. Charlie, you might want to pitch in because you helped with that grant. Do you want to start?
Yeah, it's... one of the important sort of intellectual homes of CLEAR is this field called science, technology, and society. So it's a field that doesn't really have it's not really a discipline on its own, but certainly has a following amongst very many standard disciplines. And one of the key arguments that STS scientists would make, or STS scholars would make, is that science isn't general. In fact, science is always place-based. So science requires the kinds of tools that you need to do scientific analysis and real scientific insights is always place-based. So in a sense, what we're doing is taking those insights that come from STS, which is the Science, Technology, and Society, and using them through the kinds of cases that we do. You know, it's marine plastics, it's salmon, it's all sorts of other things that we're looking at, which are place-based. So there are great challenges to doing place-based science. And in a way, it's a huge sort of task that lies ahead of us. But it's a very exciting one, and I think a very progressive one, because it means not only that you're doing science that sort of, you acknowledge that all science is place-based, but you're also doing science that connects into local places in fundamentally different ways. So the science that's normally done, STS scholars often consider to be quite a violent act, because it effaces places, right? So what we're trying to do is to do science that really recognizes places as the important things that they are, and connecting with people, obviously.
And part of what really brought the necessity of doing place-based science home was when I first got to Newfoundland a few years ago, I went to look for marine plastics, and I couldn't find any because everything's rocky here, and the plastics were disappearing between the rocks. But all of the universal protocols, there are two main ones, one comes out of the United States and the other one comes out of the United Nations, they both assume that every time you look for plastics on the shoreline that you have sand. Newfoundland has, what, two beaches with sand in the entire province? So the universal, quote-unquote, protocol, first of all, was violent towards Newfoundland. It couldn't actually measure here, or would measure and say, like, oh, you're plastic-free, which we aren't. And also, by universalizing that, there's a sort of violence in taking the particular and making universal in a central... And they were both sort of made in Central America, right? Or Central United States, I should say. Central America is totally different. And would have been a way more interesting protocol. So what we've done is we've made all of these methodologies that include rocks and include tools that you can build with things that you find in Outport or rural Newfoundland. And we do science with those. And we walked up to fishermen and women on wharfs and say, like, give us your guts for their fish and, give them the cod tongues and the cheeks and the britches as a thank you, which is a very Newfoundland thing. That would not be a thank you in many other places. Like, here are some giant ovaries. Would you like to eat them? No. But in Newfoundland, yes. So there's different. So we take a lot of that. It's not just incidental. It's sort of central to what we do. And the tension comes when we go to write our papers with the reviewers being like, well, how does this measure up with other things outside of this, because we don't universalize on purpose. And it's a tension we're very happy to live with.
So in that spirit, you've created a number of technologies. I mean, you're technology developers. You've developed a number of techniques and tools to use. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the technology that you've created?
Do you want to talk about the trawl you made?
Sure. And I was thinking, and I did also make a baby legs trawl. Okay, so that was actually pretty exciting. So we do have a standard, well, not standard, but a prototype trawl, which is called baby legs, and one of the reasons you use baby tights is because they are thicker and catch more of the plastics than, say, other tights. So you secure some baby tights to an open container, and you can drag it through the water and get and pick up plastics for a qualitative analysis. So the next step was, okay, so we'd like to make baby legs, but we'd like to have it so it's okay when we're fishing, which means that the trawl will actually fall down, and you could actually lose a lot of plastics that way.
Because you don't fish when you're moving.
Well, yes.
Because that would be very ineffective. But you have to trawl when you're moving. So this was the problem. Yeah.
Exactly. So it's kind of, we need an on-off switch for this sort of pseudo-mechanical thing. So it was really fun. There was probably five of us in the lab, and Max had thought ahead and bought some cool supplies that might come in handy. And I am not a physical person at all. Like, physical problems are very confounding. I will never solve a Rubik's Cube. Like, even figuring out whether a box is going to fit in the closet. Like, I actually have to move the box over to the closet to see. But there was, like, sitting, figuring stuff out, and like, oh, well, we can drill holes here, and we can cover this and with using the materials that we already did. So I think part of the do-it-yourself bit is actually awakening that possibility of people like me with absolutely no scientific background being able to participate in science and actually, like, contribute in a really meaningful way, not just picking up plastic on beach, but saying, okay, you've got a problem. Here's a basic technology. What are you going to do to change it to make it adaptable to your surroundings?
And obviously universities, when they hear people developing technology, they automatically think about patents, right? There's money to be made. And a lot of science labs will put the emphasis on commercializing those kinds of inventions and technology. So are you people are practicing a kind of open source, if I've got this right, a kind of open source technology movement. And tell me a little bit about that. Has anybody tried to challenge you on that? What have your experiences been with that?
So as you may know, as a faculty member in a university, if you invent anything, the university actually de facto gets it, right? Mm-hmm. Owns it. So I've spent a lot of time with lawyers here. So part of the reason that Baby Legs is Baby Legs, and part of the reason she's called Baby Legs, and part of the reason she's a she, and part of the reason she's adorable and has pink hearts on her is specifically because of patenting. Because if I made... So you have to do something called disclose the technologies you build to the research office, which means you have 60 days after you've made something to tell them, to give them some kind of report, and then they have 60 days to tell you whether they're going to take that and commercialize it or not. You don't have a whole lot of say in the matter. So I made Baby Legs as girly and fabulous as possible. And so you're supposed to put some sort of photograph in or a representation of the technology in. They assume it's going to be a CAD drawing, right, an engineering drawing. So I went to Sears and got her baby photo taken instead. Really? Like little soft edges. Yeah, I'll show you the disclosure form sometimes. I called it she throughout. I talked about her fabulousness. My department head at the time was a great ally and would, you know, has to write this little cover letter, and they'd be like, she, by which I mean the inventor, and then she, by which I mean the technology. So it was this giant campy farce. And at the same time, one of my students had, who's now in the lab, named Kai, and a group in one of my classes had invented something, the Plastic Extraction Nautical Instrument System, or PENIS. The penis didn't work as a trawl, like at all. It couldn't. It's a giant phallus, and it couldn't keep its head up in the water, which meant that it couldn't properly engulf the plastics in its meatus. And so I wasn't going to disclose it because it didn't work, because you don't have to disclose things that don't work. But because the power of sending baby legs into the research office accompanied by a penis was too good to sort of ignore, I disclosed them both at the same time. And the research office thought it was a bit of a joke. And they didn't respond. And then within 60 days, we were allowed to keep our license. And we thought we were good. I thought we were good. So this is right as CLEAR was forming. I thought we were good until I applied for a grant and I disclosed that I had these inventions, including the penis, on my portfolio. So I got some calls from the research office that it was time to come up, and because they thought they looked pretty good. And I've been on the news a lot at this point. So it was a long, protracted, probably 8 months process to before they believed me that I actually didn't want to make money on these, and I actually didn't want to privatize them, and I actually, for real, didn't want to commercialize them and get rich on these little cute science things until it's finally been settled. But we've stopped inventing things for the moment, because it's not just because we've done it a few times doesn't mean it's open, you know, open season on open technology. But the university is starting to change its IP address. I've been a big part of that. I've been on the committee that's been reviewing it and stuff like that.
It's IP policy?
It's IP policy. So, yeah. So yeah, they just really honestly didn't believe for a long time that I didn't want to make money. They thought I didn't understand. I think my gender had something to do with that. But yeah, solved. Once they believed me, they were actually really helpful. The lawyer started telling me different ways to like make it more difficult in the future, like don't sign the forms and lose the forms and don't answer our emails. And I was like, done. So it was really awesome, because once they understood, they actually were there to help faculty, and we got some allies in some unexpected places.
So one of the other pillars of the lab is citizen science, and I think people will be interested to know, what is citizen science? What's different about doing citizen science? How do you do citizen science? It's, I know there's a number of books out about it, but it's not necessarily on a concept that's on the front burner for everybody. So just tell us about citizen science.
Well, citizen science, we're getting the public engaged in using science technologies and making them easy to use, along with even protocols for analyzing what they find. That's really understandable and simple, and things you can source locally, really inexpensive things you can source. Everything's really user friendly.
So that's our version of citizen science.
Yeah.
There are other versions. Yeah, go ahead.
I happened to write a paper about this a while ago. mind you, citizen science, many definitions, but the one I'm familiar with is that citizen science, so there's a range of what citizen science can look like. There's the type where citizens can completely, let me think again. So citizens can completely, I'm thinking of Van Fogo.
Oh, participatory citizen science?
Participatory citizen science, where the scientists, the accredited scientists, are completely at the disposal of the citizens. So the citizens completely design, they have a question, and then they completely design the project, and the accredited scientists are there to just be like, okay, here's your resources if you need them, you need a temperature meter, here you go. But then there's also citizen science projects where I think of a lot of ecological monitoring, which we don't do as much, but where there's these grand projects, I think of eBird, where citizens, non-accredited scientists that don't have the funding for big institutions, can just go out and log a data point online, for example. What we have done in the past is beach cleanups. We've helped a few scouts do beach cleanups, and we've tested a few protocols. So we had the Marine Debris Tracker, which is an app, and we also had a paper form, and which is where the things from the app was on a piece of paper and people could fill it out. And then we had a free form where people could just fill in whatever they want, however they wanted to do that.
Do you remember that John was part of that?
You were.
He was. He was picking garbage.
And I was picking garbage too.
Yeah. I believe they were on the free form, the totally blank piece of paper.
I don't remember. I just remember picking up garbage.
I think I know what your handwriting looks like, and I think the only way I would know that is if you did the free form. So, yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah.
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 I suppose the other thing to add about citizen science is that it's especially important for problems like marine plastics, right? So mm-hmm. it's very difficult to get overall data. It's a very dispersed pollutant. It in fact fits very well with a citizen science kind of approach. So citizen science isn't people necessarily being separate from the kind of formal scientific project, right? In fact, the data that's generated out of citizen science is absolutely crucial to problems like marine plastics. So it's not a secondary thing. It's not sort of a part time or whatever. It's absolutely central to a broader scientific understanding of how dispersed this problem is, how big it is, how extensive it is, etc., etc. So it's not something that should be sort of discounted as a hobby.
And presumably, it engages people with the issue.
Yeah,
That they're actually doing the monitoring, the issue, they're and I would assume often people you work with are looking at plastics and fish. They would be people who fish, and use the resource. So yeah, it's a point well taken for sure.
And to sort of ride on what Charlie was saying is, so we have all of these do-it-yourself technologies made of pantyhose and whatever, plumber's clamps, but we also have the fancy pants $30,000. Scientific standards, because we have to validate those and make sure they actually work. When we go out and do our science, we don't use the fancy stuff and make everyone else use the pantyhose. We use the pantyhose and we use the public protocols. So we don't give citizen science one standard, but in our lab we do a better standard. And we've gotten some flack from that on our papers before from reviewers, but we've made the case that we want all of our data and our research to be comparable to any single person who wants to do it, including someone, you know, in Labrador, in Nain, right? And they're going to have pantyhose and they're going to have a plumber's clamp, but they're not going to have a $3,500 manta trawl and like a little spigot thing to put it out on. So that's one of the ethics of the lab, is that we don't do fancier science, less accessible science than what we discursively sort of do in public.
So the CLEAR Lab is working all over the province, and I know a lot of work's been done here on the Avalon and also Bogo Island. You mentioned Bogo with the participatory research earlier. Maybe you could tell us a bit more about some of your projects specifically. So specifically the marine plastics, which has been alluded to, and also maybe the participatory research in Bogo.
So just talk about our research?
Yeah.
Specifically marine stuff?
The marine plastics.
Well, specifically
also,
the projects, yeah. What the projects that the lab's been doing. Yeah.
So luckily, France just sent out an email with a giant list of all our projects because we needed to find out where they all were.
There are about 29 projects.
There are about 20 people in the lab, so 29 projects
is
isn't...
It's spread out. I'm not all that familiar with every single one of them. Mostly the ingestion studies. So we're looking at codfish, which is ongoing. We've done this for a few years now, and it's going to our third year.
Yeah.
We just did a research project on silver hake, looking at it as a potential food fish.
Capelin.
We're looking at capelin and salmon coming from Fogo.
Capelin came from all over the place.
Capelin came from wherever. Salmon's coming from Fogo.
Yeah.
Okay. We also have,
we're doing some trout in the near future.
We got trout coming in.
Got a bunch of Arctic char a few months ago from Labrador. Basically do a bunch of different species because different species eat in different areas and act differently and are more or less important to different types of people for food sources. And we always look in them for plastics because plastics carry toxicants into food webs. And some types of people eat a lot more fish than other types of people. So that's where part of our justice and equity questions come from.
We're doing surface trawl research from Petty Harbor.
Yeah.
And we have a Five Jars project that's also ongoing.
Yeah, that Emily's been working on for her entire career with us.
Yes.
Counting small poo-covered plastics from the Hudson River.
So that's part of the trawl studies. It was just a trawl from Hudson River, and I've been counting them. Microbeads, fragment, foam, and then that's with one of our partners.
Yeah, Five Jars. And some of those things are small, as small as the sparkle in a toothpaste. Like, literally, sparkles in toothpaste are made of plastic. So that's how small the thing, which is why it's been taking us so long, because there are hundreds of thousands of them, and they're very small.
We've also done a regional study of plastics in Newfoundland, so kind of bringing everything together, which has been a really, it's a literature review, which has been a really big project, where we learned that not all studies are commensurable. Right. Which makes it very, very difficult to compare findings. So it's a really big project.
Yeah, we're working on, with Alex and I, are working on a project on how to bring refusal into science. So one of the protocols that we have that comes from a feminist tradition and a decolonial tradition is when you gather data about a place, that it might be damaging to that place. So when we look at contamination in fish, a lot of people fish here as part of their livelihoods. And if we run to the newspapers or run to the academy and be like, this is a filthy fish, that might affect, that will affect people who live on that. So before we release any of our findings, we go to the place where we got the samples and we hold a meeting and we do what we call community peer review. So it's just like other peer review. You say, this is what I did. This is what we found. What do you think? Is this a valid way to look at this? And can I please publish this? And we've done that 3 times now.
Yes.
Yeah. And if the assembled folks say, like, yep, go publish that, then we do. And if they say no, then we would find out other ways to make that knowledge useful in local context, but not publish it. So two of us are working on a paper trying to talk about that as a method in science. It's very new, a new idea in science, but it comes out of anthropology, right? Like sometimes you get sacred knowledge or personal knowledge and you're not allowed to disseminate it. And you shouldn't ethically disseminate it. So we're working on that. Working on a BuzzFeed quiz. How feminist are you as a scientist or something like this? 29 projects.
A lot on the go.
Yeah. Developing and fixing some of our technologies. Yeah,
that's true. Mailing out all
all the citizen science kits to schools.
Oh yeah, we've made a bunch of citizen science kits with our devices for schools. So making a curriculum guide so it aligns, so that teachers can actually use it. So they'd be like, here, use this. And they're like, but I have to teach statistics. You're like, well, basic statistics, here's how, sort of goes into the kits. Yeah, so we've been doing that.
So in terms of your research, what results have you been getting?
2.4?
2 point. What's your result? 2.4, baby. Wow.
Is it 2.4%?
It's 2.2 now.
2.2, right.
First year was 2.4. Second year was 2.0. Tis now 2.2.
Woohoo!
So what is 2.2? Just throw someone a bone here.
To explain what I mean by 2.2, that's the percentage of plastics we found. So of all the fish guts we've gone through, all the Gadus marua cod, Atlantic codfish that we've cut up, gone through, we've found that in 2.4%, 2.2% of the fish had plastics in them. And that's comparable to other studies around the world that generally have around 30%, I'd say. Okay. So we have like one of the lowest rates.
Cod tend to have a lower rate anyway, but this is particularly low.
Yeah.
And has improved somewhat in the past couple of years, or is it small of a sample to say?
There's only two over 2 years. So
yeah.
Two-ish, just over two is normal, and it's actually impossible for this number to get better because plastics last in geological time, and it's only going to get worse, which is why we keep studying it and keep doing it. So, like, there might be a flux, but it's never going to get below basically two. Yeah. And then actually we found some that don't have plastics in them.
That's right. The silver hake we looked at from off the southern coast of Newfoundland, we found a 0% ingestion rate. So no plastics, which is very exciting.
Mm-hmm. Also, capelin and salmon, zero plastics.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's because they spawn. I mean, they're not eating anything. When you spawn, you're not doing anything. You're just swimming towards a beach to lay some eggs. So
silver hake weren't spawning, so now we figure out why they weren't eating plastics.
So the trick with the silver hake is now France is working on a paper where the finding is zero, mm-hmm. and we have to make the case for why that's an important thing to publish.
Are these all quote-unquote wild species?
Well, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, well, I think, yes, up to now we've been working on wild species, but I suppose there is I am part of the Ocean Frontier Institute, and I'm part of a module which will be looking at social license and aquaculture. So there we will be shifting, the lab chair will be involved in looking at pollution issues amongst farm salmon as well. So doing samples to see how many bits of plastic are in farm salmon.
Yeah.
And then asking other questions about basically waste around aquaculture facilities. So it's a marine pollution question. So then it's right in the sort of ambit of what CLEAR does.
Okay, so where do you see this work leading? And is the lab providing information to policymakers, or could it affect policy potentially down the road?
Yeah, I mean, we could.
Is that something you're actively trying to do? Or?
Yes and no. I mean, Newfoundland is a small place, so policymakers already know about our work,
right.
Because we know them individually and because they hear us on the radio. But the will for policy in this province is not towards environmental goods. Right. We also don't think that policy is the best mode for making social change. We will produce a white paper out of our regional study. I have produced white papers before. We'll keep doing that because they're not unhelpful. But most of our mode of social change happens in our protocols. So changing the world through the process of doing science, not leveraging the end results of science. So before I founded CLEAR, I used to think that the only social change that mattered was the revolutionary kind that sort of changed social structures, and that science was one way to do this. But I have now been educated by people like Emily and France and others in the lab who have also informed me that actually it's really important to make a safe, vibrant, exciting, safe space in science for people who are usually violently rejected from science or sort of not welcome. So a major part of our research is just making the lab a healthy, good sort of homey space, careful space. So we're working at multiple scales that way. But policy work isn't one of our main goals, because I personally don't think it's the world's best way to do change. We're working with industry on the aquaculture thing, because if industry changes something, that does shift how pollution works. While policy has not yet been shown to do that in the case of plastics at all, with maybe the exception of the plastic bead ban, which we did work on, which I worked on with Five Gyres, our partners, right? So occasionally we do that, but it's not our main giddy up. Anyone add anything to that dystopia?
What was the question again?
Policy work.
Oh.
Types of change. Not,
I know that there's... I found out what a white paper means in this lab.
So, John might be able to speak to this a little bit too, because you were on the beach with your son cleaning up. But
just once.
Just once.
Yeah.
But you work with local groups on beach cleanups. So, can you guys speak to this a little bit?
Sort of. Beach cleanups aren't useful ecologically, but they're useful for data. Right. And so because people are doing them for ecological reasons, we then leverage that for data generally. We don't advocate for beach cleanups, but if people are gathering stuff up anyway, they can log it for us and we can get really nice quality, wide dispersed data about it. So, yeah.
I want to maybe kind of draw the lens out back a bit. And we've talked a lot about science, and yet... you know, this is actually a humanities research center, right? So we're talking a lot about collecting hard data and so on. And your lab is infused with a lot of ideas from the humanities field, with feminism, equity, and so on. A lot of stuff from science and technology studies. Are you consciously trying to create a kind of bridge between the two cultures that C.P. Snow talked about? Or is this something that's a little bit more iterative? How do you see yourselves within the academy? Are you trying to break down barriers?
Throw that out there. Well, basically, I give no shits about the academy. Mm-hmm. So I'm not trying to like bridge parts of it. I'm trying to do really good work. And that takes many, many disciplines. And that, I would say, is true of almost any complex problem, especially environmental ones. So I'm not like being like, oh, science really needs to talk to humanities more, and humanities really not science, there should be some more. So no, I'm just like, what needs to get done? What are the best ways to do that? Drawing from all the different disciplines that can be leveraged for that. So one of the places that's probably our most social science-y is our animal ethics work that we've been working on slowly and are sort of doing iteratively as it comes up. We used to use scientific protocol, which means all animal tissues are biohazards, and you would treat them accordingly. Leveraging things from like Newfoundland studies, area studies, ethics, and just knowing Newfoundland, I managed to petition the animal ethics folks not to call it biohazards, because it was from food, from fish that Newfoundlanders were eating, and they didn't want me to go to the news and be like, you know, this university treats traditional food as biohazard. So that wasn't actually a big deal. They're very happy to do that, and they were very cooperative. But now, talking to other folks about how to kill well, the responsibility you have to animals, even if they're animal parts, the responsibility you have not to interrupt flows in different worlds with science. We return the guts back to the water where they came from. We use different feminist studies for that, decolonial studies for that. Different protocols from humanities and social sciences to change how our science is done.
Well, that leads into another question. I mean, you've thought a great deal about the relationship between doing science and the non-human world. You had a workshop last winter about feminist ways of thinking about the way we use animals in research. And I'm just being interested, what came out of that workshop? What kind of protocols, what kind of ideas did you generate out of that?
So you were there. That was when Emily and Michelle talked to the waste group, waste STS group. Do you remember the sort of takeaways from that? It was a general conversation. So we invited Michelle Murphy and Emily Simmons up for those conversations.
Okay. Yeah.
And they strayed away from something that was that specific pretty quickly. And they just started mostly talking about ethics in science and research in general, actually. Figuring out how to get permission to go certain places. There's no such thing as informed consent in science, right? So some of it was talking about that sort of thing. There certainly isn't for informed consent for animals, but no is there for land or communities or samples or anything like that. So that's mostly what I remember talking about. And just sort of not, it wasn't about informed consent. That was the starting place. It's not good enough. So how do we do good when we do research in general terms? And it was about really thinking, I think, about how you don't go out to communities and do research there. You're part of a community. You start from a community. And so being beholden to that and not sort of leaving the academy to find the out there of community action, I think was one of the big takeaways.
Yeah, and the other one is that, again, and this comes from the insight from that we get from STS, right, is that there is no big E ethics, right? So ethics is not something general that you can have, you know, across the planet or even across Canada, right? So there's no big E ethics. Ethics, just like science, is situated, right? So every time you come to a situation, you need to ask the ethical questions, and they will depending on that situation. So for the lab in its own practices, as well as when we're working outside of the lab, ethics is always at the forefront, always. But it's always the question that needs to be asked at that time, in that place, and in that context. And I think that was the other big takeaway that came from that particular workshop, right? Which is then it sets a very different relationship between, you know, the way the lab works and its ethical practices, as well as with the way in which we work in the field. So there's no way that you could just have a sort of lab manual, which we're in the process of building, which would say, this is our ethical principles, right? And then, you know, to sort of list them in a series of bullet points, that would be impossible, because they would need to be shaped depending on the context, right? So, particular situation.
Yeah, which means they're not arbitrary. They're deeply place-based, yeah. Right? And actually, you have to do a ton of research and work to figure out what they are.
Yeah.
Collaborative work. Yeah, interdisciplinary work.
So what lies ahead for the CLEAR Lab? What's in the future? Do you see yourself sticking with marine pollution or moving into other areas? What's the future hold?
Well, what are you two doing?
Staying in marine research.
Staying in marine research.
Just in my life. I have not a single clue what I'm going to research, but I feel like no matter what I do for the rest of my life, it's going to be like... Feminist. I can never do science. I feel like it's just so integrated in my being to be like feminist scientist. I can't imagine like not doing that. It would just feel so wrong.
Which means you can work in three places. That's not true, but it's kind of true.
Like, there's a lot. Everything we took learning in this lab, we're gonna take with us wherever we go.
And in terms of the lab, we're brainstorming. I have to mention like the most feminist.
So. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
It's not a secret. It's on the wall in really big letters down there. So.
We have been brainstorming just every now and then whenever we think of something about writing the most feminist science article, most feminist article in the world, which includes like a land acknowledgement, lots of other feministy things.
Hand-drawn maps.
Hand-drawn maps.
A section on fear.
So colors. Citations and colors. Works only being personal communication references, or just very quick or different things like that. And we're continuing with the COD study.
We're beholden to doing the COD study.
Yeah. Right?
Like, we work for communities now, and that's the expectation, is that we don't parachute out when we're bored of counting plastics and cod guts.
Okay.
So that we keep doing this every few years for generations if we can, right? So these folks represent the next generation of this lab. After I retire one day, Emily will come back and be director of the lab, or because you can't get a job as a feminist science in a row.
Yeah.
That's
an Newfoundland thing.
Yeah. And then, like Charlie said, moving into some of the aquaculture and the less nature-y science sort of stuff. And moving into Labrador, actually. We've been invited to work in Labrador now, which we had to be invited to because it's Indigenous land. Well, every land is Indigenous land, but Indigenous nations there have some amount of sovereignty, and we weren't going to bust in and be like, you need our work. We had to be invited, and we've now been officially invited quite strongly. So we're going to go up to the five different Inuit communities that are there and start working on those food webs, using traditional protocols and stuff like that, and basically just paying people to go out into the land and do what they would normally do, but save the guts for us. And they will tell us how sampling protocols work. They will tell us how gutting protocols work. They will tell us what counts are important, and we'll just work for them. So.
And that's terrestrial wildlife?
It's whatever they want. So if they're, so there's a caribou ban, but seals, rabbits, whatever they want, I will do. Regardless of whether it makes sense to me or not. Because if it makes sense to them, then that's what matters. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming in this afternoon. And hopefully we'll get a chance to talk again and get an update on your work.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
For more information on the Civic Laboratory for Environmental Action Research, check out our show notes or just go to https://civiclaboratory.nl. To find out more about future episodes of Cross Currents, you can follow us on Twitter at Nexus Center, search up our Facebook page, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or YouTube. This episode was edited by MUSEP student Kyle Johnson. The music used in the podcast was licensed under a Creative Commons license, and you can find out more about the music through links on our show notes. The Nexus Center is generously supported by the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences at Memorial and the Vice President Research Office at Memorial University. For episode 3, we will be talking with Professor Rose Ricciardelli about her work on the mental health challenges faced by first responders. We hope you can join us.